When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hello, I'm Matt Kelly.
And I'm Matt D'Ancona.
And this is the Two Mats for the week ending Friday, the 1st of March already. 1st of March.
Bloody hell,
where's it going?
Where does it go?
The podcast that gets things done and not in a boring way.
Well, I should hope so.
What's that leading to?
I have a feeling that that's what we've established is pronounced as segue into our conversation with Tom Baldwin, who's got a great new biography of the biography of Keir Starmer out.
Yeah.
We talked to Tom about the book and what he thinks about Starmer and, crucially, what kind of a Prime Minister Starmer might be if he wins.
And also pertinently to this podcast, potentially Keir Starmer's relationship to a new relationship with Europe.
Which is very interesting.
I thought it was very fascinating. So what are we going to call this episode?
I don't know. The Man Who Knows Starmer Best?
That's good.
That'll work.
The Man Who Knows Starmer Best.
The Man Who Knows Starmer Best.
Or The Man Who Knows Starmer At All.
That would be me, wouldn't it? Okay. The Man Who Knows Starmer Best.
So this is The Two Mats, episode 34, The Man Who Knows Keir Starmer Best.
Enjoy.
So we are very delighted to say we have Tom Baldwin with us this week for the Two Mats podcast.
On the publication day.
Is it publication day today?
Of his biography of Keir Starmer.
Congratulations.
We both enjoyed it very much.
Welcome, Tom.
Well, thank you. I walked past my small independent bookseller this morning and a small crowd had gathered around in excited anticipation. People were pushing each other aside.
Really?
Because these books are running out, and so if you haven't bought one yet, do it while you still can.
True story, listeners. True story.
Yes, absolutely.
True story.
Well, the true bit is I was pushing people out of the way.
Exactly.
Well, congrats on the splash it's made, because
it's been everywhere, and rightly so. Shall we just jump in
Why don't we jump in, Tom? Yeah.
So, Tom, we've known each other a long time, way back to the Sunday Telegraph when you were political editor, a great distinction, and now you're an author again and having had a period of time in politics and then People's Vote. So you know Labour and the progressive world very well, but you were approaching this as, you know, with your journalistic hat on, really. There are so many phrases in it that leapt out when I was reading it, but one of the descriptions of Keir Starmer that I thought sort of was a good way in was you describe him as someone who is both extraordinary and very ordinary. And I wondered if you could kind of unpack that for us.
I think part of the problem we've had in politics over the last few years is we expect political leaders to be a certain thing. We expect them to fit straight lines and a template. And then when they fail, we say, oh, we hate politicians. And one of the many paradoxes of life at the moment is people say they hate politicians and also say they want Keir Starmer to behave more like one. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't fit these straight lines. He's complicated. He doesn't have a tight backstory. It's a messy one with loose ends. He doesn't have some grandiose vision which will solve everything. He has a more pragmatic approach to pursue values. Because the problems we've got in this country are complicated. The solutions will necessarily be complicated. So why do we expect our politics to be simple and fit straight lines? He doesn't. And I kind of think that's part of the reason he's succeeding.
As I read it, there's this extraordinary personal backstory that is complicated and messy. And his family is such a huge part of who he is. But the more I read it and the more I started to... I understood his dad more than I understood him at the end of it. You know, I understood where his dad came from, why he felt embittered by the way he was treated in his community, you know, as a tool maker, which, you know, as you say, in working class society, that's actually a very prestigious, aristocratic kind of working class job. But he wasn't in a working class community and he felt kind of put upon. And he was a very diffident guy. So I understood his diffidence, but I wasn't entirely sure about why Keir, who is clearly portrayed in the book as a guy that privately is not diffident, is great fun, likes a pint, and I'd like to explore that a little bit more. You know, clearly is very social, plays footy all the time, is obsessed with the Arsenal, but publicly appears diffident and technocratic and kind of austere as a man. And why do you think that he is reluctant to let some of that warmth that he shows privately into his public persona?
I think part of it is that childhood, in that your life in Tannhouse Road, Hurst Green, Surrey, the 1970s, revolved around this extraordinarily sick mother who was...
This is Joe, yeah.
This is Joe, Keir's mother, who was constantly going to hospital, and Starmer describes this time when he wasn't sure whether she was coming back and he waited up all night. He thought, yeah, it was his sort of duty as a son to wait and see whether... She came back, and then the father comes back and says, go to school. She's okay.
Yeah.
And this happened time and time again. And in that place, there wasn't a lot of room to emote or say, I'm really worried about this. People were worried about whether Joe was going to die.
Yeah.
His dad, Rod, was pretty austere anyway. He wasn't going to allow a lot of emotion. But you're not learning to express your feelings like people do now. So partly it's about the 1970s. Partly about it's about his dad. Partly it's about the peculiar circumstances of his mother. There were other, you know, his brother had learning difficulties. You know, there's not a lot of space to be filled with emotions and so on. You just get on with it.
Yeah.
And you batten things down. But he's also, the things you talk about football and the pub, he's always reaching for things that make him more normal. If you're a teenage kid, you don't want to stand out.
Right.
You want to be like everyone else. You don't want, he didn't tell his friends that his mum was sick.
Yeah.
Does that make him stand out again? He didn't have a TV at home because his dad wanted to play Shostakovich and he'd have it all the time.
Yeah.
And so you get to school, they're talking about Starsky and Hutch or Tiz Was or whatever you were. He can't join in the conversation, so he plays football. He does have a connection to real life, but real life is what normalises him, and I think it still does.
Right.
So it's quite an important component of his makeup as a politician now. He doesn't want to make his family part of the prop, or part of his brand as a politician. He doesn't want to let everyone film him playing football all the time or see him down the pub, because that's how he refreshes his sense of himself.
Although you make the very good points in the book that every time there's a photographer, not at his invitation, but there, when he's playing eight a side, the normality of that eight a side diminishes.
Yeah.
So, you know, if he does become Prime Minister, at some point, that realm of protected normality is going to be almost... non-existent, isn't it?
The walls are closing
they're
in.
They're closing in, yeah.
And, you know, he's talked a lot about his childhood in a long-form way, which I think is okay in the book. But once you make your children part of a slogan, you're kind of diminishing your relationship with them. I mean, at one point I suggest to him that, you know, Boris Johnson did a very expensive refurbishment of the Down Street flat. He could rebuild a replica of the Pineapple Pub inside Down Street. He can install his friends, Colin... Con Peacock could be there with a pint.
Yeah.
And his eyes light up for a second. And he goes, no, we can't do that. We don't need money. But I think because he is ordinary and extraordinary, that ordinariness and finding ways of constantly refreshing that is really important to him if he's going to continue to be the person he is now if he wins the next election.
On his the formation of his ideas and, you know, the constant refrain, no one knows what he stands for and so on, I think one of the things that I really found revealing in the book was the extent to which, you know, he goes to Leeds and then he goes to Oxford to read a postgraduate law degree there, does very well, and starts, you know, as a lawyer very early on in his life, writing textbooks about human rights law. And am I right in reading that sort of human rights law is his what Blair would call his irreducible core. You know, that's where a lot of his values come. Not all, but a lot of his political values come from.
Yes and no. I think he's always positioned himself on the left, but in a sort of vague identity way. I think he has values rather than ideology.
Yeah.
You know, this brief flirtation with this obscure thing called
Pabloism.
I love Pabloism. I am now a Pabloist.
Can we have a quick elevator pitch on Pabloism, please, Tom?
It's apparently post-Trotskyist, in that it's about bottom-up self-empowerment, red-green politics of the 70s and 80s. And some of that actually is still in him. You know, when he talks about, you know, devolving power, when he talks about some of the green stuff, I think there's still flickers of that around. But interestingly, when he had this magazine called Socialist Alternatives, which he was part of, and the people producing it said the thing that stood out in their memory of it, he was the guy who got it out.
Right.
He was the guy who was interested in the distribution.
Right.
He wasn't interested in having hours and hours and hours of discussion about what does Pabloism mean.
Right.
He wanted to do the practical side of it. And I think in his expression of human rights or his expression of his politics now, it's about doing rather than just talking.
Right.
And so, you know, he did write these textbooks on human rights, but they're practical guides how to use human rights.
Right, they're manuals. Rather than.
And he does keep coming back to, you know, one of his, you know, early clashes with Dominic Grieve, who's now a great defender of him, was, you know, he was defending...
Who was Attorney General in
2010, or Shadow Attorney General in 2009. And he wrote, he did a speech as when he was Director of Public Prosecutions, defending the Human Rights Act against the Tory plan to abolish it. Well, they still haven't abolished it. But Dominic Grieve, who is now a sort of part of the traditional Conservative Party, so therefore can't be a member of the Conservative Party.
Could be a member of the Labour Party.
No, he's still a Tory.
I'm being facetious.
I wouldn't be surprised if he voted for Keir Starmer.
Yes.
Who he has enormous respect for. But, you know, he had a clash with Dominic Grieve, defending the Human Rights Act then. Probably the policies most consistently defended throughout his career has been the Human Rights Act, but not as a lefty thing. He sees human rights as something which defends victims, which extends Britain's soft power abroad. It's a very pragmatic tool which allows you to get a lot of things done,
yeah,
rather than human rights, yay.
Yeah.
And I think he's evolved in how he sees it.
So he sees things in terms of utility rather than, you know, how can I use this now? How can I use this to affect the change I want to make, rather than saying, here's a big set of dogmatic values and I'll head forward no matter what.
Yeah, he does have values, but he pursues them pragmatically, and that takes you to radical places. It takes you to change your mind.
Yeah.
So if you're looking for the most practical way to get from A to B, you may change your mind.
Yeah.
If you're looking for the most practical way to achieve change, you may challenge some of the old shibboleths in the Labour Party. And so most politicians define themselves as primarily radical. I've got my big radical vision. And then, if necessary, pragmatic. He defines himself as primarily pragmatic and, if necessarily, radical. Now, that's no fun for political journalists who are looking for the big idea. Will it work? But it may actually get you further. Mm-hmm. They turn their backs. That's boring. He's just like following the footpath. There's another guy sort of rock climbing using only his teeth. But following the footpath might be the better way out.
Well, let me just briefly play Devil's Corbynite and ask you, because they loathe Keir Starmer.
Some of them do,
especially the more vocal ones on Twitter, you know, especially the ones that he no longer takes for lunch and stuff like this, like Owen Jones and stuff like this. They despise him and they call him a liar, the most duplicitous, most devious man who only, you know, the only thing he has is ambition and he'll do anything to get to a point in power. And he's done more 180s than Luke Littler. You know, he is absolutely, you know, he's done more U-turns. I've worked on that one long ahead. This isn't off the cuff.
We're here all week, by the way.
Took me ages, that one. But, haven't they got a point that he has in, because you talk about, you know, you can change your mind, but you have to examine the compression of time in which he's changed his mind over some fundamental things and so completely haven't they got a point to say, well, he is more about getting into power than he is about any set of guiding principles?
Some of that, I think, is true. Look, he's a very, very competitive person. Anyone who's played football with him says he's so hard and competitive. And that's something I don't think people necessarily see. So he really, really wants to win, and he really wants to succeed at everything he does, and he perseveres. But that's not the same as 1-0 to Arsenal will do.
Yeah.
It's not winning for the sake of it. And I think there's something about this changing your mind in politics, which we've kind of all got to grow up about a bit. I mean, most people in real life change their mind. You know, if you're running a business or a school or you're working as a carer, you change your mind about how to do things as facts change. In politics, it's seen as some sort of cardinal sin. Mm-hmm. And I mean, maybe I'm odd on this. I don't think I am. But I'd actually quite like to have a leader who says, yeah, well, I was wrong about that. All the facts have changed. And if I was wrong about that, how do I improve my performance? How do I make sure it doesn't happen again? If the facts have changed, well, I changed. Rather than a leader who says, I said something in the year 2020, before COVID, before Ukraine, before Liz Truss did whatever she was trying to do, but I'm going to say exactly the same thing now because I've said it and therefore I've got to stick to it. I don't think that's the best way of governing the country. That's not to say I don't want people to have consistent values and stand for something, but how you apply those values has to change according to the circumstances. And I, rather than distrusting him as a result, I slightly trust him more for his ability to admit that he gets things wrong, and he has got things wrong. I trust him more for his ability to adapt to different circumstances rather than pretend that everything is the same, as Theresa May once said. Nothing has changed. Things do change. Politicians should change. And I think that's quite English. I mean, it's like common law or our road systems. It bends to the folds of the landscape rather than trying to drive a tunnel for every hill you see.
Yeah.
It more resembles what the country's like and what the people of this country are like, I think.
It's interesting that, you know, he didn't become an MP until he was 52. And it occurred to me that by the age of 52, Tony Blair had been Prime Minister for 9 years. Mm-hmm. And we've been through an era where, I mean, not Blair, but a lot of, especially on the Tory side of the House, politicians have been career politicians. You know, they've gone in straight after university, become special advisors or joined a think tank. They've never actually had any contact with the outside world at all. And, you know, it's clear in your book that it wasn't even certain that he would become an MP. You know, it could have gone either way. And I'm fascinated at what point you think he thought, right, I really am, this is, I'm going to go into politics. I want to make a difference in that way. You know, I've done my time as DPP, but I'm not just going to head straight back and become a, you know, extremely wealthy silk. I am going to try my hand at the top table.
I think it was a gradual decision and a pragmatic decision. He definitely wasn't someone who spent his entire life sort of practicing his Labour Party conference speech naked in front of the mirror, imagining...
Or reading Hansard.
Yeah, no, definitely not. And, you know, he was not just a lawyer, he was a very successful lawyer. And success tends to define your identity. You know, you have this courtroom voice, you win arguments on the basis of facts and evidence, on quite narrow legal points, rather than great arcs of oratory. And so it's quite hard to then change who you are and be a retail politician and bend to all the things that politicians are meant to be. And to some extent, he has changed. He's got much better at his speeches and his interviews, but he's still not perfect. He's not the best. I don't think he'll ever be the best, but he's got better because he perseveres. Why he went in is this pragmatic, you know, I want to bring change. I can bring a certain amount of change as a human rights lawyer, but not enough. Working inside the system, I can bring more change. Becoming public prosecutor, I can bring more change. That's still not enough. I want to get my hands on the levers of power, so I'm going to become an MP. Unfortunately, then went to 9 years of opposition.
Yeah.
And he hates it.
Yeah.
And it's so odd listening to him. He goes, I've achieved less in these 9 years than I've achieved at any other point in my life.
That's fascinating.
Like, hold on, you become leader of the Labour Party, you've turned the Labour Party inside out, you've gone from a 20-point deficit to a 20-point lead. I haven't changed anybody's life.
That's fascinating. Yeah.
And he's just so frustrated by that.
Mm.
Do you think, I mean, what hardened his desire to be leader? Was it Brexit? Was it the downside of Corbynism? What was it that made him think, I'm the person to take charge after Corbyn loses?
I think he didn't go into Parliament with ambitions to be leader. The summit of his ambition was probably to be Attorney General in a Miliband-led government. And then he gets there, and Corbyn becomes leader, and Trump becomes president, and Brexit happens. And then Corbyn becomes leader again. And he thinks, this is a bit of a shit show. And quite early on, he's going back to his office after big events. Chris Ward was senior advisor at the time. So they used to practice what he would do if he was leader. How would you respond to the budget? What would you have said at that point? Not on the basis that he definitely would, but I need to start getting better at this thing called politics, which I've now decided to do. Because he was very stiff at those early years.
Yeah.
You know, he was very lawyerly. And he spent a lot of this period trying to find ways of fitting what a political leader is meant to be better, but he's still quite stubborn.
He doesn't want
to give it all up.
There must have been a confidence. He must have needed some inner confidence to grow within him as well to say to himself, well, I can be leader, you know. And I wonder how much of that was that he was surrounded by, you know, another accusation is that he's a very lucky general and that he's been in opposition during the worst Tory government in living memory. You know, he didn't have to do anything to lose. But I wonder, do you get the sense that he is a born confidence guy? No, or is this had to grow within him that he's up to the job?
It's really interesting. He's not confident in the terms of sort of swagger and arrogance, but he does have a pretty profound belief in his capacity to get something done. But it's all pain. He keeps going, but he goes on and on about, he gets that from his mother.
Right.
Because she was always in agony. Even to walk down the stairs was agony. And she would walk up hills in the Lake District every summer on holiday. And he says, well, if she could do that, I'll just have to screw myself and get on and do with it. And he has this relentlessness, which is extraordinary. And you don't see it in an interview. He doesn't show it. But he has this confidence of purpose. And no matter how much it hurts, he doesn't like some of the things he's had to do in politics. He doesn't like politics. He tends to put all the things he has to do in politics, whether it's talking about his parents or breaking a pledge, into the same category of bad stuff I have to do in politics in order to achieve a bigger purpose. Whereas I think other politicians would make bigger differentiations. He doesn't. He just, that's what has to be done. That's what I have to do.
Tom, let's take a very quick break there, and we're going to come straight back and talk more about this brilliantly written, by, sorry to be so condescending, but it is a brilliantly written,
I'll take it, I'll
great
take it.
Rattling
really
read.
Yeah.
Read and we'll come straight back after a short break. This podcast is brought to you, as ever, by the New European newspaper. And I hope you know what the New European is by now, but you may not subscribe. And I just want to say, please do, because it's the best way to support our independent journalism. And this week, I have a superb offer for you, which is a free signed hardback copy of James O'Brien's brilliant book, How They Broke Britain. Have you read How They Broke Britain?
I have, and I think it's terrific.
Honestly, it's magnificent journalism,
well,
isn't it?
I can't recommend it highly enough.
And it'll make you
angry and think,
yeah, all of those good things. And we've got plenty of signed copies by the man himself, James O'Brien. And you can get a free copy of James O'Brien's book when you subscribe for just a little bit more than £1 a week. And you can go to theneweuropean.co.uk/2Matts to take that great offer up. Please do.
Brilliant.
And there's a link in the show notes.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
So I suppose the natural question to ask, Tom, is you've described him in greater detail and with more eloquence than anyone so far. I think it's the book you have to read to understand him. What sort of Prime Minister, on the basis of, I mean, you can't, obviously there's stuff you can't know, the circumstances we can't be absolutely sure of, but let's assume he gets into office with a reasonable majority. Let's take that as a common ground. We know he's shifted, and the sheer velocity with which he's moved since 2020 is amazing. You know, he's shifted from the 10 pledges of the leadership campaign to the 5 missions. We're now in a very, very cautious pre-election strategy. You know, nothing left to chance. Could he, might he be more radical in office? I mean, he talks about a decade of renewal. This is someone who's thinking of 2 terms rather than 1.
Yeah, sometimes I think when people talk about his policy shifts, they classically see the glass half empty rather than half full.
Well, let's look at it half full then. You know,
well, yeah, if you go back to the 10 pledges, he's not nationalising water, but he is taking rail into public ownership. He is creating a publicly owned Great British Energy Company. He is looking at investment, new investment in public services. He is introducing new workers' rights from day one. And there's a lot there. There's a big, you know, ambitions which he set about in these missions, which are very personal to him. Talk about breaking the class ceiling, ending the snobbery that holds people back. No Labour leader's talked about that for a very long time. Mm-hmm. He does it for a personal reason. It's about his brother and his sisters who he left behind, who didn't go to university. And he knows that they haven't been valued and people haven't seen their worth. But there is an edge to a lot of all this. And I remember some interview he did with Laura Kernsberg back last summer. And she said, are you sticking to the 2-child policy? It was a rather nasty welfare policy, which the Tories introduced. And there was no explanation. There was no reasoning. He just said, no, we're not going to change that. That then became the story. In the same interview, he says he's looking at increasing housing benefits.
Right.
Now, if I'd been behind the camera working for Ed Miliband at the time, as I had been once, the story coming out of that would have been, Red Ed promised to splurge billions of pounds on housing benefit hike.
Right.
They totally ignored that. Because the underlying narrative about Keir Starmer is what he's not going to do rather than what he's going to do.
He's a traitor to the
people think they've
Labour
got
caused.
Thick.
Yes.
Yeah, so look, I think to some extent there is a radical in plain sight here. I think the way he talks about a new relationship between the state and the people and the state and private sector is really interesting. You know, there's a kind of communitarianism there. There's a corporatism there. There's something we haven't seen for 50 years. But it's not ideological. So at the end of the book, I'm pushing him harder and harder to tell me if there's a Starmerism. I said, this thing about the state, isn't that it? And he then goes into a very long anecdote about Gordon Brown telling him how businesses have changed since the financial crisis and want to be more involved in society. Then he tells me about how his mate Colin, who was meant to meet in a pub that night, but he can't because the plumber's here to fix the boiler, and it's freezing in there, by the way. His mate Colin down the pub, he works for Procter & Gamble, he knows how business works, so he agrees with Gordon Brown. Then he goes on about the Arsenal Community Programme and they're a business and they have to do stuff in the community. So I go, so you've got an ex-Prime Minister, you make down the pub an Arsenal to explain your relationship. Like, that's very Starmer-ish. Yeah. Is there a Starmerism? And he goes, oh, I don't know, I just want to get things done. At which point his wife says, if you want to get something done, you can start by ordering a takeaway because we haven't got any food. So there's this constant ordinariness in how he's describing quite extraordinary things and quite big ambitions.
Yeah.
And I don't really want him to be more extraordinary. I mean, he's not perfect. He's not the best speaker. He's not the best debater. He's not the most visionary politician. He will be quite dull for a lot of reporters to cover it, unless they reprogram themselves. But I like the fact that he's still quite normal.
But to that, OK, so in the book you say some of those who know him complain he lacks the political instinct to see how emotional connections rather than rational calculation can bring change. And something Matt and I have talked a lot about on the pod is, you know, we live in an era of politics as show business, surface entertainment, and, you know, populism, which is all about simple answers to complex problems. And we know what a disaster that's been, but nonetheless, it has become the arena in which we all operate. So the question is, can he survive in that arena, or by sheer force of character and showing not telling, change it?
Well, the proof will be in government.
Yeah.
And I would say two things. One is, he's changed the Labour Party in an unshowy way. He didn't come in 2020 and say, I'm going to turn the Labour Party inside out, I'm going to do these big reforms, I'm going to throw my predecessor out. He just got on with it, step by step, pragmatic decisions, to a point where you get radical change. He's also got a record in running a big government department. He 7,000 civil servants at the CPS. And he did bring change, and he challenged the institution. When he thought they were wrong, rather than, you know, circling the wagons and trying to protect the institution, he challenged them on violence against women and girls and lack of rape prosecutions and things like that. So he does have a record that you can look at. I think there is a problem. You know, he talks about a decade of national renewal. And he says that's been national because everyone has to come with us. We've got to inspire people to see that there's possibilities of change in this country. We work together like we did during COVID. Now, a lot of people say, I think it's a fair point, that he's not exactly a person to inspire people.
Yeah.
You know, people don't know what his missions are, let alone get inspired by them. They definitely don't know that they've got a key role in delivering them. What he will say, and he always goes for a football metaphor, I'll do my talking on the pitch.
Yeah.
Now, if I can get something done, that's much more inspiring to people who have seen big promises come to nothing again and again and again, or big radical solutions, whether it's Brexit or austerity or modernity, make my life worse rather than better.
Yeah.
So if you can, in an unshowy, unflashy, unvisionary way, get some houses built. And watching houses built isn't the most interesting thing.
No, but it's important.
Yeah, and it's probably a better result than gathering a big crowd around you like Boris Johnson did to watch them set fire to the houses we already got.
Yeah. So he may be, to extend the football metaphor, he may be more Arsene Wenger than Bill Shankly, for instance, or Jurgen Klopp. More kind of quietly progressive rather than demonstrably poetic in his politics.
One of the people who play football with him regularly says he's not the best player. Talks a lot, you know, organising the defence, but he's not shouting and screaming. But he has a capacity to be in the right place at the right time.
Okay.
And when he became leader of the Labour Party, all his friends, he's a barrister, Doughty Street, all his friends said, well, Keir's got no chance of winning the next election. He said, oh, you watch him. Mm. I played football with him. He gets the right place at the right time. He will win. So, you know, you don't always see the run.
Yeah.
You don't always see what someone's doing, you know, to find that pocket of space or wherever they find in football. But he's a lot better at this game of politics than people make out. And step back from this. The same people who said he had no chance of winning the next election are the people now who say, well, you can't change a country if he gets in.
Yeah.
And they may, you know, there's no reason why they're, you know, they could be wrong once and right the next time. But I do think they should show a bit more humility.
Yeah.
And not make the mistake, as so many people have, of underestimating
him. Of underestimating him, yeah.
Do you think, I mean, just drawing to a close on, do you think he has the capacity to be remembered as a consequential change prime minister?
I don't know, because you know,
that's, I don't mean that, will he be one, but does he have it in him?
Oh, yeah, does he have the capacity? Yes, I think he has the capacity to bring change. And I've seen that. We've all seen it. We just haven't given him credit for it. He has changed the Labour Party at extraordinary speed.
And it nearly all went wrong after the Hartlepool by-election. As you reveal, he nearly threw the towel in.
And that's why he's being able to bring change. He's not going to cling to power because all that matters is power. He went into the office in the morning after the Hartlepool by-election, which another red wall seat, which Labour had lost to Boris Johnson, saying, it's getting worse under me, I'm not making a difference, I'm quitting. And several hours passed before he emerged in public and made a statement. Phone calls were made to his wife, his friends. He had to be persuaded that he could win the election. He wasn't just sitting there as leader, clinging on.
Yeah.
And that impatience, that perseverance, that drive is, I think, his most important characteristic. That combined with perhaps the superpower of bringing quite radical change and people still thinking you're dull. I mean, you know, what a result. You think people think you're reassuring and dull when you've been on this white knuckle roller coaster ride for the last 3 or 4 years. What an achievement. I mean, you know, compared to this lot, you know, I mean, you know, the hysterics, the daily panic, the daily crisis.
Interesting catastrophe.
Yeah. I mean, that's, how we grown up reporting politics? You know, big grand visions, visions crashing down. Who's next? Who's up? Who's down? And Keir Starmer's moving his building blocks around, trying to build a house. I mean, a boring walk away, and you've got a bonfire there. You've got a pile of corpses there. And you've got a new house there. Which one do you want?
Yeah. Listen, we've got to let you go soon, but this is the New Europeans podcast. So we must ask you about what you think, and you may not know this, but what do you think is in his deep heart's core about Britain's relationship with Europe? Where do you think, once he's got into number 10, will he become more radical in moving us forward to a closer, more meaningful relationship post-Brexit?
I think it'll be closer, but it won't be as meaningful as I, probably you.
Yeah, definitely me.
What about me?
And you, Matt. Everyone called Matt. Yeah. No, look, there's a few of us. And, you know, most of the country. I mean, I first really met Keir when I was working the People's Vote campaign. And I was trying to persuade him, along with Alistair Campbell, to back the People's Vote campaign. And he was a stubborn bugger. It was hard. And eventually he did. But he certainly wasn't a first mover. He wanted to get something like a customs union, not the customs union. He wanted a bespoke customs union. He got quite a long way down negotiations with Barnier on it. And then was eventually persuaded that, you know, soft Brexit was at that stage the least popular option. Where he is now, I think he's in a slightly different place. He doesn't want to expend all the energy of a first-term Labour government opening up these arguments again. Probably not getting very far. I'm not sure there's huge appetite in Europe to have us back at the, you know, this rather awkward country back in at the moment.
Yeah.
There are lots of deals to be done, one by one, incrementally, some low-hanging fruit. At some point, bigger decisions will have to be made. At some point, those incremental decisions amount to something which people might condemn, or you hit a cliff face. I don't think he wants to come to that place, certainly in the first term. I don't know what shape it looks like. And I also think outside events are going to change Europe. I mean, if Trump wins, suddenly Labour's plans for a European security pact become very relevant and Britain's in the lead.
Yeah.
Because we're going to be fighting Russia on our own. Now, forget the debate about single market. It's about how Britain will be leading a European security pact.
Yeah.
So the exact shape of this is yet to... All I can tell you, I think, is his attitude, which is he wants closer alignment. He's not batshit crazy like the Tories and unable to take basic decisions in the national interest. I mean, that's where we've got to.
Yeah.
They literally can't do things which everybody wants them to do because they're governed by people who've lived in the badlands of the fringes of politics for the last few decades. I mean, it's extraordinary. They're in power. So you'll get sensible, pragmatic, incremental moves towards a better relationship with Europe. But it won't be the big move that you want, and probably me.
Yeah, cool. All right. Well, listen, that's disappointing, but probably...
Well, it might not be disappointing. Objectively, it might not be disappointing. We'll have to see, I guess.
You know, all politics is a choice between better or worse.
Right.
Rather than perfect and,
imperfect.
Yeah.
Or wrong.
And, I mean, in this case, I think it'll be a choice between better and much, much worse.
Yeah.
Great. Well, that's certainly true.
Tom, thank you so much for that. I found it absolutely fascinating. I'm sure all the listeners have. And the book, Keir Starmer, the biography, is on sale now.
Yeah, crowds are gathering.
See if you can lay your hands on one of the few last copies available.
One critic called it the political book of the year.
A very, very...
Really? Already?
A very wise man described it as that.
Excellent.
And he's always right.
Well, I can just say it is a rattling read, and you do shed light on a man... who has avoided illumination to date. So thank you for doing that.
Thanks,
Tom.
Thank
you for coming in.
Well, thanks so much. Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Well, thank you very much to our guest, Tom Baldwin. We must get him back on.
We definitely must get him back
on. At some point in the future. Yeah, fabulous. And the book, Keir Starmer, the biography, is on sale now. Please get in any questions, any feedback to twomatts@tnepublishing.com. That's the number 2, MATTS. @tnepublishing.com. Or if you listen on Spotify, you can message us there very simply. And that's exactly what Alison Richardson did. And she says, just want to say thank you. Well, you're welcome.
You're welcome.
Your last Q&A was fantastic.
De nada.
I sometimes feel alone in my worries about tax, ultra-processed foods and wealth. So good to hear
you are not alone.
Thoughts. You are not alone, Alison. And as you've asked for more, you will get more, I can guarantee.
So shall it be. Let it be so.
It shall be so. We're back with a new Q&A episode on Sunday. Remember our subscription offer. You get a free copy of James O'Brien's brilliant book, How They Broke Britain. Just head to theneweuropean.co.uk/2mats. Maybe we should get some copies of Tom's book as well.
We should.
Yeah, I'll speak to the publishers. There is a link in the show notes. Thanks as ever to producer Matt Hill at Rethink Audio. And until next week.
It's goodbye from me.
It's goodbye from him.
Goodbye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.